I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Our guest today is Dr. San Luoma. He's a research ecologist at the University of California, Davis. Today we're talking about Coeur d'Alene Lake and its mining history and some of the pollution that's a result of that. It's a long history, Peter, and have you been up there?
No, I have not. And have you?
I've been through Coeur d'Alene. I've seen the lake. I haven't gone on the lake, though, myself.
Okay.
It's a big body of water.
It's a big body of water. I've seen pictures of it. So, and, you know, when we look at this discussion topic today, it's not uncommon. It's just not here in Idaho. We've got water issues from whether it's mining, lumber. There's a history of all kinds of concerns within our bodies of water here in the United States. And, you know, it's a great topic to really think on.
Well, we'll dig into that a whole lot more. Now, Peter, I understand you have some nature news for us.
Totally. Leif, do you think bad guys have any redeeming qualities?
I hope. I would love to think so.
Yeah. You know, can we look at an egotistical, power-hungry, greedy person and say deep down inside there's a bit of goodness in them?
I'd like to believe that.
Yeah. Okay. So University of Michigan really did a study with both adults and children to see if that's true. And with both adults and kids, they more often reported that villains were inwardly good than good guys who were inwardly bad.
Okay.
So a bad guy has some redeeming qualities. A good guy absolutely can't do anything bad.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, yeah. And so they had basically three studies, and with a total of 434 children and 277 adults. In the first study, children viewed villains' actions and emotions as overwhelmingly negative, but it did not prevent them from appreciating their villainy, you know, because they're like, well, there's some good underneath them. So, you know, we can look at them a little bit differently. They're just not horrible people all the way around. And then the second two studies, two and three, assessed both children and adults' beliefs regarding the moral character of heroes and villains. And again, the results are that both children and adults see villains' true self as overwhelmingly evil and much more negative than heroes. But at the same time, they felt that villains had some inner goodness, while a hero was still inwardly good and did not have any room for wickedness.
And can do no harm.
And can do no harm or no wrong, you know.
So that goes to what humans desire to have empathy or believe the best in all people?
You know, I think so. And I mean, I guess, I you know, that's a hard approach for me to take because, you know, we all have good to us. But, you know, if we do something bad, we do something bad, right?
Right.
And we kind of have to be honest with the fact that good guys can do bad things, and just because a villain, you know, a super mad evil scientist does one good thing in their life doesn't make them redeemable.
So does this mean that we have blinders towards people we view as good and heroic?
Totally. Yeah.
Downplay any possible negative. There,
right. That's my hero, and so they could do no wrong.
That's an interesting bias.
Yeah, totally.
Well, Peter, we've got a very interesting talk today. We're going to dig into the history and the current day of Coeur d'Alene Lake. Our question today for trivia time is, what were the most important minerals that came out of the ground in the Coeur d'Alene Valley? Some of you might know that answer, but we will all know the answer by the end of this episode. When we come back from the break, San Luoma joins us to talk about Coeur d'Alene Lake, so stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Here at NPR, we try to reach all kinds of listeners.
My name is Leo, and I'm 8 years old.
And we take feedback very seriously.
I never hear much about nature or dinosaurs or things like that.
So when Leo wrote us about our appalling lack of dinosaur coverage on All Things Considered, we knew we had to talk to him. Hi, Leo.
Hi.
I hear from your parents that you want to be a paleontologist when you grow up, and now we've got one on the line for you.
Okay.
Let me let you ask a question.
How did dinosaurs grow to be so big?
This is hard-hitting journalism because these are the types of questions that keep paleontologists up at night.
In public radio, we value our relationship with each and every one of our listeners. You listen to us, and we listen to you too. So keep our connection strong. Donate to this station right now. Here's how.
You know who covers dinosaurs really well? The Nature of Idaho on KISU. Support NPR and KISU programs by visiting KISU.org and click donate.
Welcome back from the break. I want to welcome our guest today, Dr. Sam Luoma. He's a research ecologist at the University of California, Davis. So first off, thanks for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, Dr. Sam Luoma, tell us about yourself and what you do.
Well, since Earth Day 1970, I've worked on pollution problems, environmental problems. I went back to school in 1970 for a degree in zoology at the University of Hawaii, studying mercury contamination in one of the small channels there. Since then, I went on to work at the U.S. Geological Survey for about 32 years, and then on to UC Davis all the time, looking at contamination in aquatic environments. I also work with water issues in California. And I was asked by the National Academy of Sciences to chair this committee on the future of water quality in Lake Coeur d'Alene.
So how did they choose you, in a sense? Because you're down there in California and Lake Coeur d'Alene is way up, you know, at that panhandle of Idaho.
Yeah. Well, first of all, science is kind of science is a global enterprise. So we work all over the place. And one of the places that I grew up in Montana, one of the places that I was always interested in was the Clark Fork River that runs through Missoula, just over the mountain from Coeur d'Alene. And so I have about 15, 20 years that we studied the Clark Fork, its the effects of it, the metal contamination coming out of the copper and copper mine there, and also the remediation as remediation proceeded. So they needed somebody with expertise in the impacts of mining in aquatic environments, freshwater environments, and also people who are interested in nutrients. So the committee was 13 people with a wide array of expertise, ranging from aquatic ecologists to myself, a contaminant specialist, to a variety of people with different kinds of physical and geochemical expertise.
Excellent. Okay, so we're talking about Lake Coeur d'Alene. Could you describe the lake and the setting?
Yeah, Lake Coeur d'Alene's in northern Idaho, as you all know. There are two major rivers that come into it. It's a long lake. I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact length, but it's a very large lake by standards in the U.S. It's one of the large lakes in the U.S. The Coeur d'Alene River comes in from the east, and the Coeur d'Alene River in the watershed of the Coeur d'Alene River, beginning in 1880, when the western of United States was undergoing this massive mining bloom. One of the biggest mining operations in all of the West occurred in Coeur d'Alene. And there was a tremendous amount of land disturbance that occurred around that for literally a century with little or no regulation. I'd say no regulation to speak of, discharging toxins as well as disturbing the landscape. In the south of the lake, the St. Joe River comes in, and that is the homeland of the Coeur d'Alene tribe. The whole lake was once the homeland of the Coeur d'Alene tribe, in memoriam, as they say, or in perpetuity, it's always been that way. More recently, there are many stories about the shifts in who controls what parts of the lake. But the southern part of the lake is largely affected by the St. Joe River, which has no mining in its watershed. There's also, I think, one of the reasons that the sponsors were interested in the National Academies looking at the lake had to do with the very rapid population growth going on there. A couple of years ago, the Wall Street Journal called Coeur d'Alene the hottest real estate market in the U.S. So, and if you go there, you know, you see development all the way from Spokane in the west along the corridor to Coeur d'Alene. And so there was a great concern about what the population growth would do to the lake in terms of, with population growth all over the country, whenever this happens, we see nutrients come into the lake start to grow noxious plants, and the condition of the lake begin to deteriorate. So right now, the lake in the summertime is a very beautiful, clear place. It's a tremendously valuable resource economically, again, as the homeland of the tribe. And lots of lots about lots of biological, potential biological resources for fishing and hunting and things like this around the lake. It's a tremendous resource. But the worry is, what is the effect of this population growth? And will that add on to the historic problems that have come with the mining district? The mining district, cleanup of the mining district began in the 1990s, actually in 1980s is when it was commissioned, 1990s. Our study showed that the remediation is improving things to some degree, but there's a tremendous amount of contamination in the lake still, and a long ways to go in terms of cleaning it up.
Help me understand. I get the idea that there's mining in the vicinity of the lake and within the watershed of the lake, but how does the mining operation release materials that then end up in the lake? What's the process by which that occurs?
The old mining processes were very crude. They shoveled. They dug down to the beds of concentrated minerals. They threw the waste rock onto the land. They took the mineral resource, the mineral beds, and out of the ground and put them into whole beds that extracted turned the large particulate material into fine particulate material, and then used chemicals to extract the minerals that they were after, concentrate those, and then the material that's left they sluiced onto the land. And the historic through up until 1980, the wastes, these mine tailings waste, were sluiced into the rivers. By sluiced, I mean mixed with water and just shoved into the rivers, flooded onto the floodplains, and spread across the floodplains. Now, this mining district is only 35 miles from the lake. So the lake is a big settling pond, essentially. So you create all this waste, you spread it out over the land, the floods of the natural floods of the river spread it out even further. And as soon as the rains happen or the snow melts in the spring, it washes down, hits the lake, and settles to the bottom of the lake. So contaminants are, because mining processes are not 100% effective, as a matter of fact, they're very ineffective in the early days. They become more effective, but still associated with all the minerals that they extract for profit are a large quantity of materials associated with the waste material that again contaminate these floodplains and ultimately the lake and the river. So lead, zinc, arsenic are the main contaminants that are associated with this specific ore body. But again, there's a tremendous disturbance. Of course, forests are cleared. There's tremendous disturbance of the watershed. Almost the whole floodplain of the lower basin of the Coeur d'Alene River now is covered with these fine-grained wastes from mill tailings, from the material, again, deposited over 100 years. And remediating that becomes an immense problem.
You know, I'm sitting here thinking as well, you know, as they're spreading this out along the watershed, and you lose all that vegetation. And yeah. The vegetation is the thing that really holds the soil and the minerals and the nutrients together. And by removing that, you've compounded the issue. You know, whenever there's rain or snow melt, all these contaminants have nothing to slow it down. And so they're moving into the watershed and into the lake that much quicker.
And that's a real problem in mining districts everywhere. What's even worse is that the material on the floodplain is toxic to most plants. So it's very hard for plants to naturally regrow. So usually remediation involves breaking up that soil, bringing in some organic material. This is all subsoil that's washed there, bringing in organic material and trying to get some plants to grow. But it's because it's so toxic, only certain kinds of plants will grow. This adds a lot of complication to any kind of cleanup in addition to the massive area involved.
So where are these contaminants sitting then in the lake?
In the lake itself, the contaminants in the watershed occur both on the particles, on the mill waste, the waste that came out of the mineral extraction processes, and they also leach out into the groundwater. So the groundwater goes into the rivers, the particulates go into the river. Those two go in as both dissolved and particulate metal. They get to the lake, the particles settle to the bottom, and the dissolved materials stay in the water column of the lake. And in this case, zinc concentrations in the lake water column are very much higher than any other lake in the U.S. They're extremely high, especially large lakes. There might be little small waste ponds or something, but large lakes in the U.S. don't have anything like this in terms of zinc concentrations. So the metals are both in the water column, some metals, and stuck with the sediments on the bottom. The contamination in the lake, the toxic level, let's just talk about toxic. The toxic level of lead in sediments, for example, the initial toxicity, it occurs at about 100 to 500 parts per million. That's pretty high. In Lake Coeur d'Alene, lead in the sediments ranges from 1,800 to 4,000 parts per million. We're talking about extreme contamination in the sediments of the lake. Yeah.
A little more than twice.
Yes. That's when you say twice, I don't, you know, what does that mean? But when you say 100 versus 1,800?
Yeah. It's big.
Yeah. It is. So go ahead.
Well, so these sediments initially will come in as particulate and as dissolved components. So the particulate as sediment that ends up on the lake floor, as sediments on the lake floor, are they getting reactivated? Is this the kind of lake where the body of water actually turns over because of temperature contrast throughout the year? Or is it a stable stratified lake that stays stable over time?
Well, there's turnover every year in Lake Coeur d'Alene. And one of the implications of that is that it is stratified in the summertime, but that isolates the bottom water from the surface water. So the fate of these metals in the bottom of the lake was one of the great concerns that the committee was asked to look at. If we have enough nutrient input into the lake, for example, because of population growth, and the bottom waters are sealed from the top from oxygen in the summertime, that organic material can settle to the bottom and ultimately consume oxygen in the sediment. If it consumes enough oxygen, the sediment will go anoxic toward its surface, in which case this lake would mobilize arsenic and phosphorus out of those sediments. That is not happening anywhere in the northern lake that's contaminated. Way in the south where there's not much metal contamination, it is happening. There's a small mobilization of arsenic in the south, but not a great deal. But where we have this huge arsenic concentrations in the north, it's very important to make sure that we don't get such nutrient into the lake that does not happen. Now, right now, nutrient concentrations in the lake are not close to that. But again, population growth is always something of concern. So it's very important that doesn't happen.
So I want to recap that. So the chemistry that's happening here is when we add nutrients to the water, that encourages algae and other plant material to bloom and grow. When that decays and lands on the lake bed, it changes the chemistry down there toward being low in oxygen, and that releases metals.
That would release certain metals.
Okay.
Arsenic and also another nutrient, phosphorus. Now, let me emphasize, this is not occurring in the northern lake right now, but this is the reason for concern, and that this is the reason we have to be concerned about the growth of population. Other metals, like lead and zinc, tie up in the sediments with sulfides, which are unlikely to be, in this specific case, because of the nature of this sediment, those are unlikely to be released in this case by anoxia. However, the same processes might lower pH, which could release some zinc. So one of the points is that if we allow excess population growth, excess nutrient accumulation in the lake, then there is the potential to release some of these metals back into the water column. And that's one of the concerns. Again, what we showed in our study is that as a result of remediation, metal inputs to the lake are declining. We don't see yet any increase in that little 30-year window we have, but especially in the last decade, we don't see the results of population growth increasing phosphorus in the main body of the lake. So right now, there is not a trend that suggests this, but there haven't been many studies done on the margins of the lake, which is usually where we first see such effects.
Right, and thanks for that clarification. Now, where would be the primary sources of phosphorus that would be coming in because of population growth?
Septic tanks, waste treatment facilities, the shopping centers, hard surfaces, everything we humans do stirs up the soil, disturbs the watershed. Where do our toilets and our sinks flush? they have to flush somewhere. That has to go somewhere. And we do have, again, septic tanks and waste treatment facilities. But it's one of our recommendations is that advanced waste treatment for this lake, because it's a trapped body of water and it's vulnerable, advanced waste treatment as much as can be passed on to the people would be really important for this lake ultimately. Again, emphasizing we don't see those trends yet, but it is important that we're aware that those are potential problems.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it too, phosphorus is a fertilizer and we've got lovely green yards and all this other good stuff. So the initial phosphorus that goes into the lake can create an algae bloom. And then we go through that cycle again where the algae grow, die, fall to the bottom. And one of the things that they release as they're decomposing and becoming anoxic is more phosphorus. So now that phosphorus is moving back up and sustaining that bloom up to a point where eventually you're going to run out of oxygen because the algae is, you know, it's a large lake, but if you've got a smaller lake, it doesn't take a whole lot for an algae bloom to basically kill off that lake because there's no oxygen left.
Right. And so we don't want to get into that cycle where we've got accelerating nutrient concentrations. And so as a result, and what we recommended is that it's hard to predict for the future. I mean, try to predict future water quality, extrapolating past trends, which is one way that people predict the future, probably the least reliable way. The other thing we did was look at potential for what kind of changes in climate have been occurring in the Northwest and in this basin, and how would those affect the lake? And things like earlier runoff, longer, warmer water, longer periods of isolation of the bottom water, things like that can happen in a warmer world. So what would the effect of those be? So again, one of our big conclusions was that we're seeing a positive trend as a result of remediation. We're seeing a declining, some decline in metal concentrations coming into the lake because of remediation. And we're not seeing, we don't yet see an accelerating increase in nutrients in the lake, but all this could change if we start to see bigger runoff from the watershed, for example, more frequent storms or more intense storms as are occurring in some places. Warmer temperatures could, again, increase the rate of snowmelt during some times of year, again, larger floods, bringing in more materials, which could contain phosphorus or lead or other toxins. All those things threaten these positive trajectories that we see in what's going on now.
So talking about some of the group's recommendations here, you mentioned water treatment, a quality of water treatment that would help reduce the amount of phosphorus coming in. What are some other...
Well, as scientists, of course, we're always going to say we need to better understand the processes, but indeed we do. There's a lot of the understanding what controls nutrient inputs to the lake, for example, from some of the small streams, especially from septic tanks. The flux of nutrients or the movement of phosphorus out of the sediments into the lake, how important is that right now? Understanding those and cycling within the lake of phosphorus and these metals, better understanding of those of the details of those could help us look at what control measures might be most effective. We also felt that when lakes start to deteriorate, and we've seen this in Lake Tahoe, when lakes start to deteriorate, it usually happens on the margins, inshore, next to the housing, places like that, we start to see the growth of nuisance algae, start to see, you know, filamentous algae or filamentous plants growing along the shorelines. Those are all signs that the lake is beginning to deteriorate, but you don't yet see those signs where the lake is now being monitored in the main body of the lake. So we recommended increasing the frequency and location where the lake is monitored, both in terms of metals and in terms of nutrients. Where people are active in the lake, it's important to monitor there. And in selected bays, you know, maybe some of the most contaminated bays, for example, and inshore locations. And also, one of the big assets of this lake could be it is already a place where people come to fish and boat in the summertime when it's clear. But there have been very few studies of what the legacy of mining has done to that fishery. Is there the possibility we could improve this fishery tremendously? So better understanding the food web of the lake is also important. But all that is probably secondary to expanding advanced waste treatment as widely as it can be, because advanced waste treatment can take the nutrients out and prevent them from getting to the lake. And over we've learned across the country that that's a really, wastewater treatment is really a secret to keeping these lakes more pristine. The other thing that's really interesting here and probably a little more controversial to talk about, I guess, is that there are multiple interests in the lake, of course. You know, the tribe has a tremendous interest and has always had an interest in this lake. It's, again, their homeland. The whole lake was once a part of their homeland. The southern half is now under their jurisdiction. The department, the state of Idaho, has interests. They have control over the northern part of the lake. The Department of Environmental Quality is responsible for monitoring there and has done good work there. The interests in development, of course, contradict here what some of the other interests have. And one of the things that's most important in a situation like this, where you have multiple interests, people are always going to argue for their own interest group on the one hand, but collaboration around the science, collaboration around the interpretation of what we're learning and publishing that and talking about that together can be a real avenue to move forward together. I think that was one place that we saw that has great potential in this area. But again, these are ultimately interest groups with different missions, different interests. The conflicts are not unexpected, but some degree of collaboration and the science is a way to pull that together could be really beneficial in the system.
Yeah, it's with those partners, you can't approach with one entity is going to win. You've got to find that compromise where all three, you might not get exactly what you want, but for the benefit of the lake and the whole ecosystem, you've got to find that compromise where at least all three parties do win to some level or benefit to some level.
I've worked on this quite a bit with water issues in California, which are pretty controversial themselves. But one of the things, I agree with you, there are going to be issues where people are not going to agree. On the other hand, if you can find a few places where you can agree and you can say, well, we can move forward on this together. We all agree this is important. Beginning to find those places where you can agree can be a really important factor in making positive accomplishments instead of only conflict.
Well, I appreciate you and your group doing this necessary work, observational work. And I hope that future efforts along these lines can help expand the knowledge that of what the situation is, to come up with good solutions that are based in reality and based in observation and understanding the system as well as possible. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Can you help us with our trivia question for the day? We asked think maybe this is common knowledge, but maybe not. What were the most important minerals that came out of the Coeur d'Alene Valley? I say that because I'm a geologist. Of course, everyone knows that.
the first thing that came out in large quantities was silver. So usually most of the places in the West that were started came from gold and silver exploration. And lead was another great product coming from here. There are very few lead mines in the country, and lead was another big product, a little bit of zinc.
All right, awesome. We really want to thank you, Dr. Sam, for joining us today. And for our listeners, if you want to find out more about the Lake Coeur d'Alene study, please visit the National Academy of Sciences website. You'll find that and many other interesting studies. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you very much for having me.
The Nature of Idaho receives support from listener contributions to KISU-FM. Shows are produced at KISU Studios in Pocatello at Idaho State University, with editing and production done by Ricky Colapietro. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and all past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at KISU.org or from Spotify and other select podcast services. Send your thoughts and suggestions to noid-kisu@isu.edu.